This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's solar boom is here, but are we ready? The state keeps inching up the percentages of our power supply that come from solar, seemingly a new digit every month. And with the state's renewable energy goals, solar is going to become an even bigger piece of the puzzle in the years to come. But as solar increases, there may be some growing pains or real problems for individuals and communities who find themselves in the midst of developments they don't understand or don't want or don't feel like they have enough of a voice in. At the first meeting of the state's new solar task force this week, the members heard that cities and towns want more say in solar siting and how it progresses. And task force chair Chris Recchia, who heads the public service department, warned.
One of the key things that's missing from here is any type of planning and catching up to the fact that if you leave it to the developer to choose the site, it's not going to likely be where you want it to be.
So today on the program, we're going to drill down on one town and one planning commission member's experience and understanding of solar to see how this is working out on a town level. And then we'll get a broader technical viewpoint from Velco, which manages Vermont's transmission infrastructure, and we'll have to connect all the solar. Peter Rothschild is a member of the New Haven Planning Commission. He calls himself a moderate who supports solar but thinks we're going about it in a way that creates more tension and acrimony than is necessary. Peter, thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
So you were at that meeting on Tuesday that we just heard Chris Recchia talking at. What did you come away with?
What did I come away with was the sense that I heard the same arguments and discussions that I heard in three testimonies in front of the House Energy Committee and a joint Senate House discussion. Lots of emotion and very, very few plans and strategies for solving the issue of creating the level of renewables that we'd like to have.
And I take it that's frustrating to feel like you're hearing the same thing.
Well, it's frustrating because it doesn't accomplish anything.
What were you hoping to hear?
I was hoping to hear somebody come with some concrete proposals for how they would make this process work that does not create local strife and irritation and lots of other political issues that this has stirred up. And perhaps it's too early in that process. This is their first meeting, but it is a very large problem.
Before we get into New Haven's experience in particular, can you explain, because you must talk to other planning commissions and know about other towns, why it is that towns feel like they're not getting enough of a say in how solar developments are being sited and put up in Vermont?
Well, I don't know as if I really spend a lot of time talking to other towns. I read in the papers all the issues they have, which are similar to what we in New Haven have experienced. And my sense is that any town that ends up having more than just a few projects delivered to them are going to find the same problems, that they have no say in terms of what goes on in their town.
And that's what you found in New Haven?
Oh, of course.
So for people who are not familiar with New Haven, this is a town in Addison County. It's north of Middlebury. And if you drive up or down Route 7, you will see some solar farms in New Haven along the road that are visible just from the road. Can you give us the map of solar in New Haven for people who are trying to picture it?
I'm not sure I can. They should get their own map. We have Route 7 corridor, which is a major byway, and it also has three-phase power. Three-phase power is a critical feature in this whole process, and we also have a lot of open farmland. New Haven is a beautiful, small community of about 1,600 people. And we happen to be at the confluence of three-phase power and open fields, and hence are probably seeing a largely disproportionate amount of solar development in our town.
Well, that's what I mean. Tell us where the solar is, because, I mean, you say people should get their own map, but if you say you don't even know where the solar is,
of course I know what it is, but I'm not going to sit here for 15 minutes and explain people the geography of New Haven.
No, not the geography of New Haven, the geography of how much solar you have and where.
Well, we have in the last year since I've been involved with it, there have been over 11 projects that have come to town going from 150 kilowatt systems, which take up 1 acre, up to a proposed 5 megawatt system that would have taken 40 acres and everything in between. and they are dispersed around the town, but in particular around places where three-phase power exists.
And when you look at those developments and planned developments and you say the town doesn't have any say, is that because they're on private property and right now the private property developers work with whoever the solar developers are?
The reason that towns do not have any say is that Section 248 and the ensuing Act 56 empower the Public Service Board to vitiate local zoning laws. And therefore, every piece of property within the state, in my view, is probably open to a permitted use of solar. And that is the is one of the root causes of the problem.
Why would you like the town to have more of a say in that? I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, if the state says it's okay and the property owner wants it, why do you think the town should have more of a voice?
That's an interesting question. What we have seen, and I suspect others have seen, is that the process creates a situation where one landowner can essentially take a piece of farmland, a piece of residential land that he or she owns, and put a commercial enterprise on it. In our town, you can't do that. If you have a residential use, you can't take a field and turn it into a used car lot. That is a forbidden use. The legislation that's passed allows solar to get around that, if you will. And the problem is that the person that is hosting an array, more often than not, and probably in 90% of the cases, pushes the array as far from her house as is possible and sites it right next to her neighbor. And surprisingly, the neighbor is not very pleased. And that's what we're dealing with.
We're talking with Peter Rothschild. He serves on the New Haven Planning Commission. And we're getting his take here on what's happening in New Haven with solar development as just one example of how towns and individuals are grappling with this development. The state wants more solar power to come into play as we look towards increasing our renewables over the next few years. So more towns are going to be experiencing this. And we're hearing from Peter on New Haven's experience. We'd love to hear from you if you want to talk about what's happening in your community or maybe on your own land. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Peter, you're probably not surprised to know that we've been getting a lot of emails and posts even before the show.
I would expect you'll set records.
Yeah. We got one from Kathy who says, it's so exciting to hear where solar is heading in the state. Sure, adopting new technologies can be a bit of a learning curve, and it's important to do this with consciousness and social justice firmly in mind. But this is a fantastic opportunity to help get off fossil fuels, tackle our portion of the responsibility for climate change, and achieve much greater energy independence. So I think it's important to engage these conversations with the ultimate intention of getting to yes on solar and figuring out how it can benefit most people along the way. Do you agree with Kathy's post there?
I agree with Kathy's post, but it's totally unhelpful. The discussions about whether or not we have climate change should be off the table. It's clear we do, at least in my view. It's not constructive to sit and preach to the choir. What we're looking for are solutions, and I don't believe that that was one of them. It's taking a fact that I personally agree. We need to develop something that works rather than something that does not.
Well, here's Cassie in Windsor's take. Cassie says, Windsor citizens are not against solar at all, just where GMP and Grow Solar want to put it. We do not want solar panels covering our prime agricultural and scenic wildlife refuge, one of the most beautiful farmlands in the area. We've formed a Facebook page called Protect Your Land to make people aware of the insanity that is going on, not just in our town, but across the state, for the sake of money, and not in our pockets, but the pockets of big companies. And Mark says many people consider Denmark's energy program to be the most successful in the world. Denmark has a collaborative planning process, standards for siting and operations, and a multidisciplinary board that promptly adjudicates disputes between energy operators and neighbors. Vermont has none of these things. Vermont's energy policies and practices maximize conflict. Developers make the siting choices, and the Public Service Board rubber stamps them. Energy developers are given free rein to override municipal and regional conservation and development plans lands. This is why dozens of towns have passed resolutions calling for energy siting reform. So Mark and Cassie feeling frustrated by the process sounds sort of similar to what you've been seeing.
Yeah, the expression goes, I feel their pain, but once again, that doesn't offer a solution. I mean, I think what they're perceiving, and I've seen it, is that essentially solar developers are perceived as an invading mercenary army. And they are emboldened and they're armed by the PSB, which is also given power by the legislation, so that the local towns really are out of the process, which is anathema in that I have politicians that will tell us to come to our town meeting and participate. The town participates, passes zoning laws, town plans, and then the state government blows them away. This isn't great policy. I would like to see something where the towns are really incented to work with the state and with developers to solve this problem.
If you could write the rules, do you have a solution that you – I mean, you said you want to see a solution. Do you have one in your head that if you were in charge you could do?
Yeah, I think – I mean, I have an idea. I'd be be too much hubris to think that I have the answer, which has eluded everyone else. But I really think that I would not have a problem if each town in the state were compelled to produce a particular amount, a number of megawatts of power related to their population. So it's a per capita number. At that point, leave it up to the towns to execute it. And the towns will find a solution. Part of the problem right now is that the financial incentives really inure only to developers and high wealth individuals, which are backing and investing in these projects. And that, by the way, is sort of a curiosity in that, if you will, Bernie's millionaires and billionaires are really funding and benefiting from this, and the towns struggle. So I think the towns could be forced by law to produce energy. If there are towns that have no where to put them. A classic in Addison County would be Ripton, which is, I think, 95% forest. You live up in Moncton, I believe. Mm-hmm. There are places that can't go. So those towns would then essentially contract with other towns to produce their energy and pay for it. I heard on the news earlier about, I think it was Bristol with their landfill. That's a typical model where if your town doesn't have a way to get rid of its refuse, you pay another town to take it. I think that same model could be applied. And then you end up having fairness in the process. No free riders. It kind of works.
Would that take the business possibility out of the hands of private landowners? Are you imagining then all of the solar would be on town-owned land?
No, there's not enough of it. I mean, I think you end up having a free market kind of a solution. And you probably have to put it up for bid. If you don't, you end up with avenues to corruption, which is not really a very good thing. But no, there's not enough town land.
Are you getting any feedback from the state? Have you talked to Chris Recchia or anybody else at the state about this idea as a way to really incentivize towns to and give them a voice in this process?
excuse me. Not Chris directly. I actually wrote him a note recently after attending his meeting. I've discussed that briefly. The issue is so complex that, in my view, most of the politicians, particularly from the Energy Committee in both the House and Senate, don't want to deal with it. They've essentially said, here's the regulations, go eat your peas. But they haven't given us utensils to eat with, and we need them.
That is Peter Rothschild. He's a member of the New Haven Planning Commission. Peter, I really appreciate your perspective. Really interesting to get one sort of individual town's perspective on this issue that so many are dealing with. Thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure.
We're talking about the future of solar in Vermont. Peter's been telling us about what it's been like from New Haven's perspective. Coming up, we'll be joined by Carrick Johnson of Velco to explain how solar fits into the infrastructure already in place in Vermont and what might need to change. Again, if you'd like to share your experiences or what you could envision as a comprehensive strategy for our solar future, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been talking about one community's experience with solar installations and New Haven's Peter Rothschild's frustration with the lack of a comprehensive plan and vision for exactly how solar will work in Vermont, not to mention a lack of ability for towns to have input in the process. We're hearing from some of you. We've got a note from Tyler who says, I'd like to ruin the day for people who think solar arrays are unsightly. Look at the power lines and telephone poles along the roads. They're there and they have been for a year and they're ugly as sin. But you probably don't even notice them as they're such an ingrained part of our American landscape. Solar arrays will become second nature in the same way. And if you think they're unsightly, check out the spill of a coal-fired power plant's toxic ash in the Tennessee Valley and ask yourself, as compared to what? Christy says, I love alternative energy, but I wish it didn't ruin Vermont's landscape. I would prefer to see more rooftops with panels or those old road plates, which are solar panels. They made it through a Norwegian winter. Why not here in Vermont? And we got a note from Dee who says, I'm struck by a recent quote from former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who said, there is no morally defensible excuse to delay phase out of fossil fuel emissions as rapidly as possible. Dee says, we all must make sacrifices to reduce our fossil fuel consumption and move immediately to renewable sources of energy. Yes, some view sheds may be affected by wind or solar installations, but it's important that we have a visual reminder of the very real costs of energy consumption. And let's take a couple of calls as well. Ben is on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say I hear a lot these days in Vermont about the economy, about keeping young people in the state, and about tourism. And as a young person in Vermont, when I see solar, I feel a great amount of pride because it's an example of Vermont's leadership and has the potential to keep creating great jobs that millennials want, keep our energy costs low and stable, and showcase our state as a climate as a clean energy and tech leader.
Ben, thanks for the call. I appreciate your thoughts there. Let's go to Bill with us from Burlington. Hi, Bill.
Kind of piggybacking on the previous caller's comment, but the opposite end. Listen, I think everyone in Vermont is all for solar power. I think we've got to realize, though, that if Vermont went to a zero carbon footprint, we'd have virtually zero impact on worldwide global warming. Importantly, I think we need to allocate resources to what's going on in the economy of this state to keep the young people here so we all can survive. Those are my thoughts.
Bill, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And Larry's on the line with us from Charlotte. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I must say I agree with the gentleman who commented by email about the ugliness of solar power. We've got to get used to it if we think it is. But anyway, we talk about taking land out of agriculture for solar arrays. And I've been long advocating multiple use. People can park under them in shopping plazas. They keep off snow and rain. Grazing can happen if the panels are raised high enough. There is a good example on Route 7, just south of Vergennes. I see sheep in there under one section of them. And I think sheep and solar go together, like ham and eggs.
Appreciate the call, Larry. Thanks very much. And let's bring in another voice here into this conversation. We're going to take a little bit of a turn and look at how these multiple small and large installations actually connect to our existing infrastructure and what kinds of infrastructure changes we might need to have in our grid and in our system to make solar work if it's going to continue to increase and develop like it has been. We're joined by Carrick Johnson, Vice President of Communications, Systems, and Strategy at Velco, which manages Vermont's power grid infrastructure. Carrick, nice to have you back on the show.
Glad to be here.
So you heard Peter Rothschild talking about these developments, and I know it's not your purview to say whether or not, you know, or how exactly towns should have a say, but are you sensitive to what he was talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I think, let's be clear, I joined Velco in 2006 when we were building something called the Northwest Reliability Project. And we went through, made a lot of mistakes, and we learned a lot, and there were changes made to the regulatory process, statutory, and we made, I don't know, hundreds of internal changes. But we got to a better place. So I think in general, this will be fixed. I think what we've seen is anytime there are large infrastructure, anytime there are changes in the landscape on the scale we're talking about, there's going to be a reaction. But I am very optimistic that we will work these out there. It may involve changes, regulatory and otherwise, but I think we'll get there.
And when we talk about not only the size of the change, but the speed of it, I mean, 10 years ago, we had almost negligible solar power, like maybe 1% or less than 1%. Where are we at right now?
Good question. I would say, at least to be clear about Velco, we have about 800 miles of high voltage transmission line across the state. So we have a huge impact on the landscape. And what we're seeing now is that, and our job, as you said, is to run a reliable grid. So we care about data, what works. We don't care about the nature of the fuel, quite honestly. It's a federal requirement that we not care. So whether it's nuclear or solar, as long as it's reliable.
Right. So you don't technically have a say on, on where we're getting our electricity from. Technically, you don't care.
Correct. As is required, we have to be non-discriminatory in our process. But what we're seeing right now, so you raise a good point, Jane, is that solar has exploded in Vermont, across the region, and indeed across the United States. The prices come down. So in late March, we had two successive days where only the appreciable difference was cloud cover. And what we found is the difference in the peak loads at key times of the day, the differences in those 2 days was about 140, 150 megawatts, and we have roughly a 1,000-megawatt system. So what we're measuring right now is about a 14 or 15% contribution to Vermont from solar for overall energy generation. So that's a significant and rapid growth in terms of our overall energy needs.
So you're saying when the sun is shining, Vermont is getting 15% of its electrical power from solar.
I'm saying when we measured it, that it's. I want to be very precise.
Right.
When we measured it
that
particular
one day,
but our planners and grid analysts are looking at that, and that is the takeaway. And it heralds the change in our load profile and our constantly changing energy generation mix. So the change is upon us.
Okay. So, but what you also say, if I'm hearing you correctly, mm-hmm. is that there was a big difference when there was a day with cloud cover. Mm-hmm. So how, in terms of our baseline power and having consistent power sources to everybody in Vermont, are you working on negotiating that with solar, given the intermittency of the power source?
It's a good question. I would say this. Since our job is to maintain reliability, working with the regional grid operator, and it quickly gets pretty complicated, but essentially our distribution utility owners, I think your caller Ben talked about the unique aspect of Vermont energy innovation. One of the innovations is Velco itself, first in the nation, created in 1956. We're owned by a public benefits corporation in the 16 distribution utilities. They are responsible for ensuring there's appropriate power mixes. We make sure on a statewide level it all mixes. Right now with Vermont Yankees exit, we have gone from a net exporter of power really to a net importer of power. So we are incorporating and balancing that out, working with ISO New England and the distribution utilities. So the grid is absolutely reliable. Arguably, it's more reliable now than it was just even 10 years ago.
But that power source may not be.
Well, to the degree, you know, there's contract path for electrons and there's physics of electrons. And the grid reliability of anything has improved. And I think we know the major sources. There's Hydro-Quebec, a lot of in-state hydro and solar, as we've been talking about. Wind is a growing source and continues to grow. And then there's imports from various places.
We're talking with Carrick Johnson from Velco. And listeners, if you have a question for him, some technical questions about how the grid works, or if you see how solar connects and want to know a little bit more, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Bob who says, where can Vermont residents obtain information on the cost of interconnecting solar projects in Vermont based on Velco studies? And what entities are calculating the costs of infrastructure upgrades required by solar? And where are those results published?
So first, with regards to interconnection rules, I would say it depends on the size of the project. But I would start if you go to the Velco website, www.velco.com, and there's a spot there that has interconnection rules. Just click on that. It's a drop-down tab, and that will get you started. I will tell you, most of the solar projects, though, are of a size such that they interconnect directly to the distribution utility. So Burlington Electric Department, Greenmount Power, Vermont Electric Co-op, Washington Electric Co-op. So I would start with your local utility. Just call them. Or
will they tell you the costs? I mean, because that's what Bob's asking about, is the money piece here.
In terms of costs, there's procedures, and procedures relate to costs. But in terms of costs, it depends where, what size, and what the fuel is. It's very, very site and project specific.
So, Carrick, you just mentioned that, you know, somebody like Bob may want to check with his utilities first, because the smaller size of many of these projects means they're basically connecting to the utility. Is that – I'm oversimplifying what you're saying, but to make sure I understand it. So, again, an oversimplification here, but as we move forward and you see – either larger projects or projects that are not necessarily connected in the same way to a utility, how do, are you going to determine who has the right basically to plug right into the grid?
As of right now, there are studies for every project, reliability studies, and that's our focus. When you plug this in, what does it do? For those projects that are of a size that they need to work through us and work the original grid operator, there is an entire process, and you're essentially – you pay, the project developer pays for analysis because you are trying to get into a market. So you have a relationship with the grid operator. You pay the grid operator and those studies are done. And that information is confidential. But what happens is you as a project developer are given confidential information that says for you to connect, here's what you have to pay for to be able to interconnect reliably. And there's a whole set of rules to ensure that that happens.
So do you see that as part of our energy future? I mean, do you see the dissolution of our utilities as we have them now and more of a site-specific or decentralized power grid?
I would use the more I'll react to the word dissolution. I think you're going to see – I think the evolution is already underway. It's underway with us and it's underway with Green Mountain Power in particular and some of the projects they're doing. Unique in the nation, the stuff that's going here. Burlington Electric Department and some amazing programs they're doing with UVM students. Washington Electric Co-op and what they've done. Vermont Electric Co-op and their work on – and responding to storms and making that, I think the phrase that Dave Hallquist likes to use, is a delightful experience. The change and the evolution is upon us. Different Vermont distribution utilities have different visions of what they accomplish. Velco's role is we make sure we build a platform that enables them to do that. So right now, Vermont, we have a statewide fiber optic system that allows for real-time movement of massive amounts of information. We have about 94, 96 deployment of smart meters across the entire state. No other state has that level. And there's, roughly speaking, this issue you're talking about, understanding that, I'll move that aside for a bit there, broadly speaking, is stakeholder alignment on the issues that we're trying to accomplish.
All right, but you didn't answer my question because – so it sounds like what you're saying is our utilities are being innovative because clearly they want to have a stake in the energy future. And I'll read you a comment that we got from Kristen Carlson, who's the director of media for Green Mountain Power.
Sure.
Kristen says, we're fortunate to live in a state where small contributions to our clean energy future can make a big difference. We have the power to shape our energy future and decide what mix of energy we want. At Green Mountain Power, we believe in empowering our customers to shape their energy future and the future of our state. That is why we work so closely with customers and local communities when we look to establish new clean energy, whether it's solar, wind, or even new products and services. So Green Mountain Power, obviously, and others, positioning themselves to be in the marketplace as we see these sort of smaller energy generation sources coming through, people having solar power at their own home site that then they are pushing back into the grid through places like Green Mountain Power. So what are you seeing when you look in your crystal ball as to how that's going to all line
what
up?
What we see in our crystal ball at Velco is that we have been an infrastructure company. We've built $1 billion worth of assets in Vermont over the course of 6 years. What's becoming very evident in the world we're in now is about data, is about information and how we can best disseminate, manage, store, and make sure we share that appropriately. Green Mountain Power has a great vision, and they want to become that network. And our job is to make sure that they can better serve their customers by helping them and staying ahead of them so we don't hold them back. Make no mistake, we want to accelerate that integration. Vermont is like one big makerspace when it comes to energy, and it's a great time to be in the energy world in Vermont because we have to work through these and have all the respect in the world and acknowledge the kind of the tough decisions, having been through and had tough conversations in people's living rooms about changes in infrastructure. But we'll work through that. I think the kind of vision we want, we're heading into a really good place. And Vermont really is at the forefront in a lot of this.
You're a booster.
I absolutely am.
Let's go to Joe calling in from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is this. You talk about how on the days when there's a lot of sun, the 14% of it may be generated by solar. Does that translate yet to less coal or natural gas actually being burned on those days, or are we not there yet?
My response would be this. It's hard to correlate directly the loads we're seeing in Vermont and understand the generation sources for Vermont. But larger context within the region for a variety of reasons, coal and oil-fired generation they're retiring in New England. In fact, if anything, they retired a little bit more rapidly than the region understood that they might largely environmental and climate change issues. And that has meant, if anything, there's a real opening. There's an opportunity for more wind, for more solar, for more biomass.
Although I think what Joe's also talking about is that when those sources, when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining, or in previous years when the grid was really overstretched, that's mm-hmm. when those coal-fired plants sort of went into action. And you're not seeing that as much.
Correct. To the degree we're driving down the peak. Now, in some cases, it's shifting the peak time, but when you're driving down peak, that means the most expensive, dirtiest forms of energy are not being employed.
That's Carrick Johnson. He's Vice President of Communications, Systems, and Strategy at Velco. Carrick, thanks for being on the program.
You're welcome.
This conversation continues online. Please share your thoughts. We will follow up. This is obviously an ongoing conversation for the state, so go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, we'll head down to the Burlington waterfront to see the vision for what the big lump of a building known as the Moran plant could be in the future. Speaking of power, this was Burlington's coal-fired power plant in the 1950s, but the three main developers of the building hope it will become a community gathering space. That's coming up next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And now we're going to go on a field trip down to the Burlington waterfront. Right down on the water, away from the boathouse and the Echo Lake Aquarium, next to the Sailing Center, is a three-tiered, kind of squat brick building known as the Moran Plant. It was built in the early 1950s as the city's coal-powered electricity generator. But for the last three decades, it's been abandoned and mostly considered an eyesore. Earlier plans to rehabilitate the space have failed, but a new group of inspired developers is trying to drum up both excitement and money for what they see as the future home of a great community gathering point. We went for a peek inside.
I'm Eric Krockenberg. I'm one of the three project founders of New Moran Incorporated, which is the nonprofit redeveloper of the Moran plant on Burlington's waterfront.
My name is Tad Cook, and I'm also all of those things.
And I'm Charlie Tipper, ditto.
All right, so when I stand here, what I'm looking at is a really industrial space, clearly a big old industrial space that is abandoned or was abandoned until you guys showed up. And there's a lot of graffiti, which can be kind of interesting. Keep on smoking it. Good one right there. And then you look across the building and there's an owl, a very stately gray owl staring back at us. What is that?
The owl is a part of a series of art that spreads throughout the building, and it all comes from Mary Lacey, who's a Jericho artist. She grew up in Jericho, went to school in New York, and came back here. And she came to us with the idea that art would be a way to not only show the building, but also bring life to this space that has been, by and large, vacant for the last 30 years. So this owl here is one of 10 pieces.
And are all of the animals in her installation staring at us so judgmentally?
I think the owl, characteristically, may be the most judgmental. The deer, is just around the corner from us, is fairly gentle and inquisitive. The bat upstairs is keeping a strong watch, as is one of my favorites, which is all the way upstairs. There's a falcon keeping a stern watch on the building.
So in other words, yes, they are all staring at us.
They are all staring at us, but not judgmentally. I think, if anything, supportively.
We're starting up here and looking at this big grand space, and very clearly before this is something that is going to be bringing in the crowds, there's going to need to be some work done. For one thing, you probably need to get rid of all of the holes that people could fall through. So what is it you want to do with this space?
We are standing in the Moran plant's former turbine hall. So these enormous holes that you see in front of us are where the three 10-megawatt steam-powered turbines formerly sat. So this is quite literally where the electricity was produced. And this is what will become a 1,500-capacity community event center. We're calling it the Turbine Hall. We'd be looking directly at a stage right along the east wall here, and then to the west, opening up this entire lower shed. So if you were standing here, you'd be looking out at a sunset, watching your favorite band set up, or coming in the morning to a room full of children and and the farmer's market.
That's right. You want to have the winter farmer's market here.
Yep. Concerts, conferences, conventions, but also open for things like a winter farmer's market or a community banquet or a lecture series.
I actually have a real affinity for spaces that look like this, even as it looks now. I just love old industrial spaces. But I can imagine some people coming in here and just seeing an old abandoned electrical plant and thinking, this just would be so much work and so much money. So what is it that captivated you that you were seeing that perhaps other people weren't?
For us, seeing this space, it's a chance to finally create a year-round destination on the waterfront wherein there has been none. That in and of itself, we think, is a real opportunity. But there's also an opportunity. You mentioned the character and the space here, this old industrial space, and that's something that doesn't exist in very many, if any, other spaces in Burlington remaining. This particular building has a lot of character. If we were to take it down and build new, we would lose that character, but we would also lose the volume of space. We're 25 feet from Lake Champlain in a 90-foot tall building, and that's something that we can never recreate because of the zoning, because of the setbacks. So for us, it's what an opportunity to keep the character and to repurpose the building and still tell the story in a place that's very unique and very Vermont, in both representing a vibrant downtown, but also the character and the culture of the greater state. And with any luck, create a destination that is loved throughout the state and beyond.
Let's see something else. I want to see what else is going on. Oh, this is so cool looking.
You haven't been in here before, have
No.
you?
Okay, so where are we now?
We're on the fourth floor, which will be, in the future plan, a very dynamic space, as it was when the plant was in operation. We're looking at three giant upside-down pyramids, the bunkers that held the coal, that would have filtered down gravity-fed from the top of the building, two floors above us, down below and into the boiler faces directly below us.
They sort of resemble what you might see in a mill, like if you were milling grains, that sort of upside-down pyramid.
Yep. This is, it looks like the bottom of a silo feed. The other big piece of this floor is actually right outside of us on our right here, and it's the entire rooftop of the ceiling of the Great Hall, and it's a 3,600 square foot space, four floors up, right next to the lake. So that's a space that, with the structure that already exists here, we can create an open public roof deck. That, you know, Waterfront Park is one of the most visited state parks in Vermont, and we think that this roof deck can be similarly one of the most visited outdoor public spaces. We have plans for the Vermont Community Garden Network to have roughly a third of the roof with urban garden plots for their education programs, and the remaining two-thirds will be open public roof deck to have a space that's here that's available, also available for rent.
These are a lot of really fabulous plans, but there's a big price tag attached to them. I think $33 million is what it's going to cost. So how are you raising that money, and are you confident you can get all of it?
We have a $33.7 million project, and the first big chunk of that was coming from the city of Burlington. Last year, 70% of the voters approved $6.3 million for this building, for the redevelopment of the Morant plant, as part of a $9.6 million waterfront-wide allocation. The next two chunks of financing, which are almost half of the budget, are both federal tax credit sources. There's a new market tax credit and a historic tax credit. And both of those, like the tax increment financing from the city, are intended to accomplish projects that otherwise would not happen. The fourth piece of our budget is a small section of low-interest debt. And it's one of the really powerful parts of this model is that we come out of it with very little debt, with an operating model that's financially self-sustaining. And the way we're able to accomplish that between the TIF and the tax credits is with a major charitable capital campaign.
So an $11 million charitable campaign, it's not news to anybody that that is a really ambitious goal. We're really just now starting in earnest to take this on. And we've raised $1.85 million to date. And that is really, for all intents and purposes, that's proactive support. We have not been out there beating the bushes in the least. So at the same time that we are going out and actually actively soliciting support from the public, we're also setting up what we think is going to be the coolest Donate Now function that anyone's ever seen, an interactive web-based app
So you want to show me the downstairs now that we've gone up? Do you want to go up one more? Do you tell people when they're touring, don't look down if anybody's afraid of heights? Because, you know, you're looking down through this, the grades.
The disclaimer at the bottom of the stairs and let people know it's all safe, it's all structural, but it's a graded floor. And if you have shaky knees, there is no shame.
And do people turn around and say, no thanks?
Absolutely. Really? All the time, which is fine.
And you guys never get nervous?
I have been up and down these stairs enough times to not even notice that they're there.
We've led well over 1,000 people through the building at this point, so we are very comfortable with the space.
All right, let's go upstairs. So you've now taken me up to the highest part, I guess, that we can go up to, right? You mentioned earlier that one of the things that you want to preserve is not just the building's framework, but really what it represents to the city of Burlington. And people who've been following Moran for the last 20 or 30 years know it mostly as a problem for the city, if anything. But it's really important to the city's history, and it sounds like that's something that you also want to preserve. This was the source of Burlington's electricity in the 50s, and it was a very important part of the way Burlington developed, right? So why is that important to preserve as you create a new space and a new life inside this framework?
May we step around the corner?
Yes.
I think it's setting the stage. You've done it perfectly with the question, but you've got to see this.
Okay, go for it. So now we're almost on like a catwalk.
So we call this the conveyor hall.
There's a squirrel.
We have been bringing the building to life. Within these four walls is the conveyor belt and the train car that began the coal's descent down into the boilers. We're looking also down into the three bunkers, each of which held 5 train cars of coal at 55 tons per car. When these bunkers were full, it would take 36 hours to burn that quantity of coal. That all equates to 10 train cars or 550 tons of coal per day. And that, I know, made a huge impression upon me when I finally had a visual understanding of the quantity of coal that we relied on in order to power our homes and businesses in Burlington. So that is just one of the many reasons we feel compelled to preserve this story.
The other thing that we can see when we're looking at this train car and looking at the belt beneath it is on the other side here is actually a couple of small piles of wood chips, which is an interesting part of the story, in that in 1977, with an in-house conversion, Moran became the first wood chip power plant in the country, and very much an act of Yankee ingenuity. The team had a proposal for a feasibility study, which was well outside of their budget, and so Tom Carr, promised his boys, all of his guys that were working with him, that if they could figure out how to transform one, if not two, of these bunkers into a wood chip powered plant, which was at that point the only remaining feasible source of fuel, then he would give them 2 weeks paid vacation off the books. So a few weeks later, the plant had been transformed for under $25,000. So in that sense, the Moran plant has been a problem for 30 years in many people's eyes. But prior to that, it was an immensely innovative plant, and it was based not in big money or in large grants, but in real local ingenuity. And we think that that's a story that's worth telling and preserving as part of this building.
And when you think about 10 years, 15 years, 30 years down the road, and New Moran is settled in and has gone through its growing pains, what role does it have in Burlington?
I think it should be at the top of everybody's list and coming here. I think if we are successful in creating a place that people love, you know, it should be right at the top of the list, you know, right behind Church Street.
Church Street?
Well, yeah. Church Street will...
Arm in arm with Church Street.
But it should be a defining landmark location in our state, loved by the people here.
We all know in our guts there's this potential for this place to be an icon of Burlington. It's got the shape and the mass that whether you think it's beautiful or not, it elicits an opinion and people remember it. And then you combine that with its location on the waterfront. And we really do think it can be at the top of everyone's list of Burlington destinations.
Well, Charlie, Tad, and Eric, thank you so much for showing me around Moran and helping me see your vision.
Our pleasure.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks very much.
And if you actually want to see what we've been talking about, we will be putting a slideshow up at vpr.net. It'll have pictures of what Moran looks like now, that great industrial space, that sort of derelict artwork kind of feel for it. And you'll be able to see artist renderings about what they're envisioning, as well as some historic photos of Moran. Again, go to vpr.net. We'll have that up for you shortly. And that does it for today's show. Tomorrow, or rather Monday on the program, thank gosh we're not going to be here tomorrow. Monday on the program, we're going to be talking about dying and endangered languages. Abenaki speaker and language instructor Jesse Bruchak only knows of 5 speakers of the Abenaki language, including his 2 children. So we'll take a look at risk and extinct languages, what causes them to die out, what efforts are underway to keep these languages in use. You can write in to Vermont Edition at vpr.net with your questions on endangered languages, and then listen in Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.